For my part, I think belief in God lost whatever rationality it once possessed when it was discovered that the Earth is not the centre of the universe. Bertrand Russell, in the 1950s, a bit of a guru for university students, less well known now, because in a way his philosophy's passé. But he was certainly expressing a sentiment then, which was regarded as conventional wisdom, that Christianity and science were mutually contradictory and that the erroneousness of the former had been conclusively proven as a result of the advance of the latter. Well, this evening I'm here to defend a contrary point of view, if you like. The two great passions of my life, apart from my wife, are my Christianity and my science. Not a professional scientist any longer, but I still have enormous respect for science and interest in it. And I don't see those two great interests of my life as antagonistic to one another. I believe they can be fully integrated in a single worldview, which is in fact infinitely richer and more satisfying than the atheistic stance I once accepted. In fact, without my Christianity, I think my science would be immeasurably the poorer, and that's really what I want to try and get across in this brief introduction, so that you have the opportunity then to ask questions and debate. First thing I want to say is, I don't believe science flourishes in a culture, or indeed can be motivated in an individual, unless that culture or that individual is informed, consciously or unconsciously, by a theistic worldview. For instance, I think you don't even start doing science unless you believe, a priori, that we live in a universe rather than a multiverse. That there is a unifying order and rationality in the world around us. Put in religious terms, I think that means that a scientist cannot be a polytheist. And a polytheist will never become a scientist. Another thing which a scientist has to believe a priori, consciously or unconsciously, is that the universe is a proper object of investigation. A scientist has to believe that the kind of knowledge he gains by objectifying and analysing the world around him is worthwhile knowledge and appropriate knowledge, which put in religious terms, I think, means that a scientist cannot be a pantheist. For a pantheist believes the world is divine, and that to stick his nose in it, to pry into it impudently with his test tubes and his microscopes, is therefore impious. It's for this reason that polytheistic and pantheistic cultures have never produced science. The only cultures that have produced science have been those that have been informed by theistic philosophies and religions, principally Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. Now, some of you may be saying, well, it would have been a jolly good thing if, in fact, scientists had a bit more reverence for nature and had been a little less arrogant in their general attitude. Maybe a little pantheism wouldn't do them any harm. Maybe we wouldn't have had so many ecological disasters. We maybe wouldn't have the nuclear bomb if scientists had seen the universe in a more divine kind of pantheistic way. Well, certainly criticisms can be lodged against science and technology for some of the evils that they have at least potentially brought into the world in the last century or two. But I think, though the criticism is valid, it's misdirected when it's directed at theism. The reason science has given rise to problems which cause us real anxiety in terms of ecology and threats to world peace and so on in the 19th and 20th centuries is not because the scientific enterprise is fundamentally flawed, but rather because science has become detached from the theistic roots which originally informed it, and in the late 18th, 19th, and 20th century, became attached rather to an atheistic, humanistic philosophy, which sought to dispense with God and deify man in his place. That brings me to the second proposition I'd want to defend in this sort of introduction, that is, that science, in and of itself, is an inadequate basis for our human self-understanding. Science has to be complemented by a religious worldview if the fundamental needs of a human being are to be addressed. Now, there's much we could talk about in this connection, but I'll just focus down on two things which it seems to me belong in that category of the fundamental needs of a human being addressed, which science cannot fulfill. Firstly, the need for moral values. we human beings feel a sense of oughtness over our lives. We can distinguish perfectly well between the things that we want to do, the things that are easy to do, the things that other people want to make us do, and those things that we feel we ought to do. I don't believe you can derive any kind of oughtness from science. Of course, attempts have been made to base morality on reason, particularly in the 19th century. But I don't believe they work for this simple reason. That fundamental to the sense of oughtness, which is, someone's just leant on the light switch, fundamental to the sense of oughtness, which is moral, there is a sense of responsibility. You can't have morality without a sense of responsibility. And the very word responsibility implies responsibility to somebody. An atheistic worldview, I don't believe, can give rise to authentic morality. The only thing atheism can do when you ask responsibility to whom is say, well, you're responsible to yourself. I don't think that is morality. You can argue with me about that with pleasure. But I don't think you can express morality in the first person singular. It's an imperative which has to be expressed in the second person. Thou shalt. There can be no sense of oughtness without that external, transcendent accountability to somebody. That's why I say atheistic science is inadequate as a basis for human self-understanding. It must be complemented by a religious worldview if those moral values, which we intuitively know about, are to be satisfactorily addressed. The other area in this sort of fundamental needs of us as human beings, which science can't handle, is the question of destiny and purpose. Whatever we think about theory of evolution, we are different from animals in this, that survival is not enough for us human beings. We human beings demand a purpose for the fulfillment of which survival is necessary. You can argue about where that demand for purpose, that demand for teleology, as the philosophers like to call it, a sense of direction to existence, where it comes from. But again, I don't believe you can derive it from science. For this reason, science does not fundamentally answer the question or ask the question, why? Science is fundamentally concerned with asking the question, how? I think in uninformed circles, this is frequently not understood. Take the example, for instance, of Isaac Newton, the famous fellow who somewhere in Cambridge is supposed to have had an apple fall on his head and discover the law of gravity. Of course, he didn't discover why apples fell, though we often express it in English in that way. What he discovered that day was the similarity between the fall of an apple and the swing of the moon around the Earth. What he discovered was that the same mathematical law would describe both motions. He was describing how apples fall and how moons swing, and discovered that they in fact both behaved in the same way, a way that could be unified by the same mathematical equation. But in no sense did he answer the question why apples fall or why moons swing. But that's a metaphysical question, and quite outside the realm of science. One can transfer the question a bit further. Here is Ollie here, and he is breathing, at least I think he is. Why is he breathing? When a scientist asks that question, the answer you get is not a question, the answer to the question why, but the answer to the question how. Why is he breathing? He is breathing because his diaphragm is pumping up and down. And this is mobilizing his lungs, which are sucking air in and out. And this is oxygenating his blood, and so on. These are all how descriptions of what is going on in his body. But if you ask why is he breathing, in terms of the ultimate purpose and destiny of a human life, science cannot answer that question. The danger with godless science is that if you're not careful, it very easily slides into reductionism. It says that a human being is nothing but a biochemical machine, nothing but a sophisticated animal, and so on. As a Christian, I wouldn't deny that we are biochemical machines and that we are animals. But there is far more to a human being than that. A human being has a purpose and a destiny, which is not accessible to science, not because there's anything wrong with the science, but because it is simply not equipped to answer questions of that sort. And yet, if we are to be authentically human, we must ask questions of that sort, and we must have answers. Now, up till now, I've spoken about the need of science for a theistic religious worldview, and said that I don't think you can motivate science or supply the fundamental human understanding that we human beings need from science without a theistic worldview, supplementing that science, if you like. But the question that's been put as the subject of our debate tonight is Christ the saviour of science, not theism the saviour of science. Why Christ, then? Why, as a scientist, do I suggest that supremely it is Christ who holds the answer to these needs which science has? Why Christian theism rather than any other kind of theism? I'll make just two comments in that connection. First, I believe Christ deserves more attention from a scientist, perhaps, if I can put it that way, than other theistic religions. Because uniquely, Christianity offers objective evidence of its truth claims. Now here I'm referring to the resurrection of Christ. I'm not suggesting, of course, that it's possible to prove that the resurrection of Christ took place scientifically. No historical event can be proven scientifically, at least not until the invention of Doctor Who's time machine. Historical events, being one-off events, singularities, are not amenable to the techniques of scientific falsifiability, verification and so on. Nevertheless, the resurrection of Christ is an objective event in history. And the New Testament unashamedly says, if it didn't happen, Christianity is rubbish. In this sense, Christianity offers itself to the world and says, look, we say this event occurred. We are witnesses of this event. The early Christians do not present themselves as philosophers with some theory or as mystics with some experience, but as witnesses who have observed something which they say happened. And it is perfectly possible, as with any other historical event, to assess the probability of such an event, of the resurrection of Christ, its plausibility. And Christianity invites such an investigation, such a scientific investigation, dare I say. I have to say that I believe when you engage in that investigation with an open mind, you come away, if you're a non-Christian, decidedly shaken. Because the evidence for the truth of the resurrection of Christ is extraordinarily strong, extraordinarily robust. If you ask them why haven't more people been convinced by it, why are there so many scientists and intellectuals in the world who haven't been satisfied with the evidence, I have to say that there is prejudice and there is obstinacy, that there are things tied up with accepting the resurrection of Christ which make us decidedly unwilling to accept such an event. Perfectly happy to talk in a little while about miracles and that sort of thing, if that's of interest to somebody. I'm not suggesting that we can prove the resurrection of Christ, but I do believe the evidence for the resurrection of Christ is sufficiently robust to establish the reasonability of Christian claims about Christ. And no other theistic faith offers itself to the world in that kind of way. The other comment I will make in this connection of why Christ is this. Christianity also offers subjective authentication of its truth claims. It is emphatically an experimental religion, not just a cerebral philosophy. Christianity says that through prayer and through engagement with God's word, it is possible to, can I put it this way, get feedback from God himself that confirms and strengthens faith. Now again, this is not amenable to proof. Perfectly possible to claim that Christians are subject to self-delusion in this matter. But there is no denying the claim, no disputing that's what Christians say, and that to Christianity, as it were, then offers itself to experiment. Says to you, try it. In this respect, the knowledge of God, which Christianity talks about, bridges the two kinds of knowledge which often are set at poles. On the one hand, we sometimes, think of objective knowledge, scientific knowledge, mathematical knowledge even, the sort of knowledge which says, I know 2 plus 2 equals 4. That sort of knowledge perhaps would want to put God in a test tube and analyze him. The trouble with that sort of knowledge is it results in no warmth. We may feel we know things, but there is no real human warmth in that knowledge. It's a cold, calculating knowledge, a very cerebral knowledge. On the other hand, we may talk about emotional knowledge or subjective knowledge, like I know fear. Some would pursue the knowledge of God in that way, like the guru, for instance, who would set aside all rationality and try to discover God through mystical experience. But the trouble with that kind of knowledge is there's no cognitive content to it. It's purely subjective experience of the so-called spiritual. Interestingly, Christianity, it seems to me, weaves these two poles of human cognition together when it speaks of the knowledge of God. Yes, there is objective evidence to be evaluated in the resurrection of Christ. Yes, there is subjective involvement with God to be experienced through prayer. God is not just an equation to be logically proved, nor is he just a cosmic force to be mystically experienced. God, according to the New Testament, is a person to be encountered, who brings together both the objective and the subjective foci of our human understanding, both our scientific mindset and our emotional and subjective mindset. In Christ, he offers himself to us for just such a personal encounter. And as I say, I believe that is really something you do not find with anything like the same degree of clarity or testability in any other branch of theism. Christ, the Saviour of science. Well, now it's for you to ask questions.
Now, I suggest that a possible scientific explanation for human morals might be that a race which accidentally develops a human moral will survive better than human self.
The morality has survival value. Do you want to comment on that? It's not a scientific question. Perfectly good explanation. My trouble with that is, once I believe it, my morality collapses. Once I believe the only reason I'm being moral is because the race of which I'm a part assumed this for its own survival, that morality loses its cogency for me once I'm able to double think it in that way, and I no longer feel bound by its oughtness.
Morality isn't necessarily not something you have to think about in that kind of way. I once came to that conclusion myself, and I found that when I was thinking about decisions, then morality doesn't win. But you don't think about decisions that sensibly. You feel the opposite of the decisions,
right.
And morality is still applicable in that way.
Well, I don't know. Go on, you answer that one.
Well, in a sense, there's a sense in which, of course, that's true, if I understand what you mean. There's a sense in which that's true. I mean, I think you do feel it. As a Christian, I don't want to say that you always feel it exactly correctly, but I think, as opposed to the other comment, that's true. Is there a further point you wanted to make from that?
I think, to an extent, the suggestion that's been given for the first thing you said about morality could also be adapted to set the other bit of the talk as well. It seems to me intellectually plausible, in spite of the fact that I am a Christian, that human mind tends to be curious, essentially, and that's why science has developed, because we want to find out how things work. And we're always asking questions, and everyone knows, little children, from virtually the first moment they can talk, they're asking, why is the sky blue, why is the grass green? Just because science can't answer certain questions, and as you say, it isn't coped to answer certain questions, able to cope with answering certain questions, doesn't seem to me to be a valid reason to bring in a theism. It seems plausible that if someone said to me, you feel you need answers to your destiny, you feel you need answers to such and such and such and such, and so you became a Christian. I mean, that's not why I became a Christian, but it seems a plausible explanation, it seems a plausible reason for religion to develop, a kind of way of answering the questions that to kind of plug the loopholes in science.
All right, I think I know where you're coming from, what you're trying to say. You're saying that the fact that we don't have, on a rationalistic basis, on a scientific basis, answers for these fundamental human needs doesn't constitute any reason for believing they have answers. Well, that's perfectly true. I mean, you can be a skeptic. You can say we live in a meaningless universe. I mean, frankly, I have a lot of sympathy with what you say, but before I became a Christian, I got really annoyed with my Christian friends. Because they used to say precisely things like, Roy, you haven't got any purpose, have you? You don't know where you're going in life. Your life's meaningless, isn't it? And I said, yes, yes. You should become a Christian, because Christians have purpose. And I said, just like you're saying, you know, I'm not going to become a Christian just for the sake of some intellectual prop that I need to emotionally stagger through life. If there's no purpose in the world, I'll live without purpose. You know, I'm quite happy to be an existentialist and live without purpose. I think one has to have the intellectual courage, if you like, to face up to that possibility. Nevertheless, I think it is an awesome possibility to face up to. I think it is a very distressing thing to have to come to terms with. And I think it's perfectly proper to say to a non-Christian, if you are rejecting theism, you know, it's no good thinking that your science can provide you with some alternative to these fundamental things. You are going to have to face the fact, like Sartre and the other existentialists eventually came to terms with in the early part of this century, that a world in which scientific truth is the only truth you're certain about is a world without meaning, a world without purpose, a world without morality, except as you artificially create it for yourself. And that's an awesome thing to come to terms with. The other thing I think one has to say is that there is a certain presupposition, or a certain presumption, that these hungers, these appetites, these longings within the human soul ought to correlate to some answer. I mean, I have an appetite, I get hungry. My hunger correlates to the fact that there is such a thing as food, which I need. It's hard to believe that as a creature I would have this thing called hunger if there were no food around designed to meet it. I have a sexual appetite, which corresponds to a certain other sort of desire, right, and fulfillment. It's hard to believe that I feel that kind of feeling, that kind of longing, that kind of need, if it wasn't possible for it to be met. So if I find within myself some appetite for, some longing for, some need for destiny or morality, it is an odd thing if there isn't some adequate answer to it, some adequate fulfillment of it, it doesn't correspond, doesn't correlate with it. I'm not saying you can prove that there must be such a thing, but it is decidedly odd that a creature like me should feel these things and there be no real answer to them. That's all I'm saying. At the back, we'll come back to these folks
You're saying that science can't actually connect to the disagree on that. I mean, I think I've got a pretty good answer to all the
why questions
you've mentioned.
Oh, good, let's hear it. Well, why are we here then? Come on, why are we here and where are we going?
Well,
we
personally are the human race.
Let's talk about the human race first, but we'll come to you later. Is that the answer to why? Well, when I ask the question why, I want a reason for our existence, not a mechanism for our survival. You've just given me a mechanism by which we have survived better than any other species, which I perhaps would not dispute. But that is not an answer, it seems to me, to an ultimate question of why we're here. It doesn't give me any sense of personal destiny or even racial destiny. That answer you've just provided. Maybe I'm being unfair. But if that's the only answer that you have, it leaves me in just the same existential despair as this fellow was just talking about. Oh, precisely. But you see, you're only proving my point. All you've got are mechanisms. And if the only answer to the why you can give me is one mechanism after another mechanism after another mechanism, one how it's happened after another how it's happened after another how it's happened, and at the end of the day, that's all we're left with, a description of how we've managed to get to this point, without any overriding sense, underlying sense, of why on earth anything should be happening at all. Precisely. A sense of destiny, that there is some meaning to this charade of which we're all part, that it's going somewhere, that it's not just a random journey to nowhere. If there's no answer to that question, then the fundamental meaninglessness of human existence is something we have to face up to, and I think that's an extremely distressing thing for a human being to face up to. I'm not saying it's not possible for people to face up to, but I think it brings you pretty close to suicide. Well, you were going to tell us about your personal destiny, weren't you? What do you think about that? Pass on your genes. I presume you mean G-E-N-E-S. Good Dawkins fan, huh? The selfish gene. All right. Yes.
I'd like to continue that point you were making, because I could give reasons for as he was doing, but how, because there are, I'm speaking as a scientist here, there are mechanisms for how they are laid down by the physicists, but we can explain all those stages, but, and I have thought about this a lot, we cannot explain what goes right down to the very focal point of why, of what initiated those strings of how, even though we can define them and explain them on purely scientific terms. So, with what you were saying, was what was the force behind this? What was the why that initiated this whole how? Could you be implying that all that God was necessary for was to set this how going, but to give the why, his presence was the why, and once the fundamental elements were set up, it could be left to the laws of physics after that. So that means to see pleasure gets falling, do not really need God after that.
Thank you. Very good question. And recapitulates a very important historical argument, which I'm sure this man knows more about than I do. But, do you want to take this? In brief, what I want to say to that is, okay, deism in the 18th century more or less said what you were saying, that all we need God for is the primal cause. After that, the universe goes on like clockwork, and the hows are enough. In terms of explaining why the thing happened in the first place, if you like, I suppose that might have some merit. I don't find it a satisfactory answer to the wider question of the destiny of the universe, and of human destiny in particular. And it's certainly not what the Bible says. I think a more accurate picture of the way in which the Bible sees the relationship between God and the universe would be something like a television tube, in which the action is projected on the screen and has every appearance of autonomy, its own internal laws. But that whole pattern, that whole order which sustains those laws is in fact constantly, as it were, projected from behind and held in existence from behind. I don't know if that's a picture that helps, but I think that's much more the way the Bible would see the relationship between God and the universe, not as a kind of a finger poker, remote finger poker, who steps in and stirs things up at the beginning and gets things working, and then retreats, and then maybe just sticks his finger in occasionally for the odd miracle or two, you know, somewhere along the line. But basically, the whole thing is working automatically after that. Now, I think a much better picture is to think of the universe as projected out constantly by the will of God, or by the word of God, or by the mind of God, constantly held in existence by his sustaining intelligence and power. And when you think of God in that way, constantly upholding the universe, which is what the Bible says, first of all, it makes miracles, I think, less of a problem to understand where they fit in. But also, I think it's a far more satisfying understanding of what the universe is about. And if you think of the universe as just a kind of inexorable machine grinding on, kind of impersonal thing following its own internal laws, I think deism gets into all sorts of problems when it comes to the problem of suffering, for instance, from the pain and evil in the world and so on, because these things become kind of almost fatalistically viewed, rather than something which you really believe God is at work and has a purpose. And Christianity certainly affirms that, and it can only affirm that because of what it believes about the providence of God. That's a technical word, but that's why he knows more about it than I do. Why didn't you say something about that? You must know something.
Well, I mean, in several of these questions, I just feel like if I were to answer them, I'd be answering with one hand behind my back, because you keep using the word satisfying, and I'm going to go, well, okay, but there could be some, you know, our genes friend could be quite satisfied with his purpose. Now, I agree with you in that ultimately, I think, from what we know from Christianity, you won't ultimately find that satisfying. I think God has left you with a conscience. I think he's left you with a desire for a purpose, which you may not sense right now in some way, or which you may feel is adequately, you know, fulfilled. But I think over time, you'll experience things in life which that will not be sufficient for. I don't think that necessarily means you'll become a Christian. I don't know what you'll do. You may make your own view in some way, try to shift to meet that. But I wouldn't ultimately try to base my arguments on whether or not they're satisfying. I would say that God has interrupted history in Jesus. And the deists could never account for that. I mean, for them, Jesus was always an embarrassment. I mean, he was a great moral teacher, except if you read his teachings, you know, because then there were too many things they couldn't explain. So whether or not, you know, your view of science is satisfying to you, I think that it's not merely if you can construct a reality that's coherent enough to satisfy yourself, although I think it's a helpful conversation. I'd say the main thing that Christianity has to say to someone who thinks that science is sufficient in and of itself is not just you should feel dissatisfied for not being able to answer why, although I think it's true, but it's also God has told us why in Jesus. And as Roy was saying in his beginning talk, objectively, that's an historical problem. Because if you want to start being historically skeptical about Jesus, I think you'll have to be historically skeptical about a lot of other things if you want to investigate them responsibly.
Can I also say that if you're willing to accept, or if any other devout Christian is willing to accept, that with time, when we evolve more mentally, when we can have more mental capacity to maybe deduce the laws of physics, the underlying laws of physics, that we at the moment we do not have a clue, will that affect the potency of Christianity? Because we can think, well, time is a loop, in fact, and we can explain how everything, even though maybe we do not know you know, at all, that's why, if that's true, that in the future, if we can say exactly why, we can have a fundamental theory which nobody, no scientific person can refute. Will that affect Christianity once we have got everything done to see?
Well, first of all, I mean, it's hard to answer a completely, you know, unknown question like that, in a sense. But I think, in one way, I could say, no, not at all, because all you're telling me is that the bounds of how keep getting expanded. But I think there's a fundamental difference between that and why. And I think in Christianity, God has given a why in Jesus.
Yes, I think what you're saying is that we can look to a day when there will be some set of equations or some unified field theory that will give us a description, a totalistic description of all physical phenomena. Will that make any difference? I think no. Because there are certain things about us as human beings which are true, which we cannot deny about ourselves, of which our moral sense is one, and our sense of destiny and need of purpose is another. And these things will still cry out for an answer. And even though we have an answer to the how, which is all-embracing, a truly universal solution to the universe, those fundamental questions, those fundamental needs will remain unaddressed, because by very definition, the kind of answers for which science looks does not embrace that sphere of existential awareness in us human beings. Again, I'm not disputing what Marx says there. It also will not do, because there is such a thing as human history. And your unified field theory will not explain human history. And there will be certain things which have happened in human history which call forth, if you like, a decision about whether God was speaking or not in those events. And supreme among those, in my view, is Christ and his resurrection. And you still have to pass a verdict on those, and your unified field theory will not help you pass that verdict.
Do you have any doubt? Any point?
Yes, I quite understand your sort of distinction between how and why, but it seems to me what you're making about the difference between explaining and understanding, and then trying to explain objectively something that's accessible, and a why being more than intuitively. It's precisely that gap which therefore requires one to have a leap of logic to pass from the path of science. Just a very simple point. How would you reconcile, say, Darwin's theory of evolution with Adam and Eve? Can you do that?
How would I reconcile it? Christians have different ways of harmony. The first thing I want to say is I think it is most vitally important that Christians do seek a harmony between their understanding of the biblical text and the account they give, the scientific account they give of origins. And I am unutterably hostile to those who try and live in two different intellectual boxes in this. However, it has to be faced that Christians have sought that harmony in different ways. And I don't want to be damning towards Christians who take a different view of this matter than I do. But if you're asking me personally what I feel is the most convincing harmonization of these two different accounts of origins, the Darwinian one or the scientific one and the biblical one, I have to say I don't have any difficulty personally in accepting evolution as a mechanism, as an answer to the how. But I think it has no... I don't think it addresses the question of why. And so if you asked me, I would have to say, insofar as evolution has established itself as a dependable scientific theory, and I think there are still question marks about it, certainly in detail, and maybe the whole thing might finish up in the melting pot and have to be rethought. But if it were the way it happened, then I find no difficulty with accepting that it is the way it happened. The way in which God used, if you like, to develop the diversity of species. And in fact, if you think about it, Genesis chapter 1 does portray an evolutionary model. It would have been very easy for our ancient author, knowing nothing at all about evolution, to have simply said the whole of the universe suddenly sprang into being by a single divine fiat, with no progress, no development at all. But no, he spreads it out over 7 days. And he says that material things emerge first, light, and the earth and the heavens, and then plants come before animals, and marine animals come before land animals, and the human race comes only at the very end. In an astonishing way, he anticipates the general sort of evolutionary scheme, dare I say, without any of the evolutionary detail. So I don't have any great difficulty in accepting that if evolution was the way it happened, that God might have used such a mechanism for the production of the variety of species that we see, and I don't find any great difficulty harmonizing that with Genesis 1. But there are some Christians who feel that the 7 days have to be taken with a greater degree of literalness than I feel it's necessary to take, and they must look for another solution for the problem.
Yes? Going back to your television metaphor, Yes. Why science is not quite the rest of the day, leave a little bit to why, and you can expect a how. Why is it not possible for you to accept that a holistic viewpoint in that the pattern on our television exists because each part is each independent? So we live in a God theory of Earth, maybe, or a mutually central factor of the universe in which it lives because of itself, and then it's only the same as itself.
Pantheistic, if I would say you're describing a pantheistic world, monistic pantheistic world. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Why am I not satisfied with that?
Yeah, can you explain this?
Well, I think you're being unfair. This is a very, very contemporary and current view. In fact, it's more trendy than the old-fashioned sort of atheistic humanism that I sort of grew up in. This is New Age thinking, in a way. This is saying, and lots of physicists today, Francis Capra, for instance, the Tao of physics and so on, are taking this view very seriously, so it's not to be mocked. What it's basically saying is, yeah, sure, when you look at the universe, it is an extraordinary extraordinary the way it holds together. You know, the fundamental laws of physics are just beautifully balanced and finely tuned so that this universe exists. And it does take a big stretch of the imagination to say, well, it's all one big sort of coincidence that these things just are like this. And so what a pantheist or monistic view says is, yes, there is a kind of organizing intelligence behind it, but it's not a personal intelligence. It's a kind of, you know, like the Force is with you in Star Wars. You know, it's a kind of cosmic integrating force which grows, you could almost say, into the universe in the way we have it, so that things always fit together in this way. Am I being fair? And sometimes you will hear people use the word Gaia, which is really a kind of rebirth of Mother Nature and a new fancy name, and saying the universe actually has some kind of spiritual existence. But it would stand back from Christian theism. It would say, no, this is not a transcendent personal God who holds the universe out there in existence, distant from himself, and distances himself from it. This is rather an immanent deity, if you're going to call it a deity at all, which pervades all things and holds all things together as a kind of internal glue, right? Yeah. Now, pantheism is internally consistent. But as I said at the beginning, I don't believe a pantheistic culture would ever have produced science in the first place. Because I think the reverential attitude towards nature, the non-analytical attitude towards nature, which pantheism fosters, just would not generate modern science. Well, who can prove that? You can only say, look at India, or look at cultures which have been informed by monistic philosophy and see the way science has got arrested or not happened at all in them. But you can debate about that. The other thing I have to say, though, is, all right, it's internally consistent. It might be the way it is. But you've still got Jesus, who sort of is like a vertical dropped from infinity into this self-sustaining world of yours, who claims he has come from above, who speaks about a God who is out there, and who has sent him into the world. And, you know, it's quite clear that Jesus did not accept a pantheistic worldview.
Is he not reductionist in the same way as trying to see the grand unifying theory? You know, he's seeking, he's saying God is the grand unifying theory for what? Is he not reductionist?
You mean the same way his diet would be for you?
Not using diet as much as for God, but I'm saying that it is different in itself. And that. And I only did for him. And for the part. I'm not trying to reduce what I see around me. I'm only basing on what I see and what I can feel and take part of. Whereas grand unified theory,
probably in mathematical abstraction and Jesus is a mental abstraction.
Well, I think, if I'm reading you right, what you're saying is, isn't there something counterproductive about the whole idea of objective knowledge? I mean, this is precisely what I mean when I say pantheism does not foster science. Yes, science works by the scientist making himself observer and distancing himself from his environment, observing it, analyzing it, identifying similarities between different phenomena and uniting them under a common name or with a common equation, and so gradually integrating his understanding of his environment in that sort of way, but always in the perspective of the detached observer looking at the rest. And quantum mechanics in this century has greatly deepened our fundamental understanding that this is the very nature of what science is about. It requires an observer in order for it to progress. Now, it is perfectly true to say that in Eastern monistic philosophy, that pattern of analysis and cognition is regarded as impious and unspiritual and counterproductive. That what in fact you need to do is defocus your brain and refuse to stand off from the world as object over against a subject over against object, but rather be totally subjective. Feel yourself merging with the rest of the world as a part of it. And this is precisely the kind of experience of cosmic consciousness which New Age is seeking and which Buddhism and Hinduism have sought down the years. But it is antipathetic to Christian theism. For the God of the Bible, right from the very beginning when he creates the world, distances himself from it. He says, "Let there be light," and there is light, and he immediately stands back from it and says, "It's good." Just like an artist who stands back from the canvas and says, "Now I've put that brushstroke in and I like it, that can stay." And he proceeds to create the world by that form of distancing. And the mandate which is given to Adam in the very early chapters of Genesis to name the animals represents a similar distancing of man from the rest of creation and an echoing of the creator's dare I say it, scientific kind of role of looking at it, distancing him, objectifying himself over against the rest of the world and labelling it and analysing it and mastering it by separating himself from it as subject over against object. That pattern of cognition is what flavours all theism in the Judeo-Christian tradition, and without it, modern science would never have developed.
Just to summarize three points real quickly. So there's three interesting conversations you might have with a Christian friend. One would be about this idea of order, which Christians can assume because of creation, because there's an intelligent, separate creator who's given an order that, in a sense, you could say is readable. Two, the point he's made about Jesus. You could have a very interesting conversation then about who was Jesus. Was he a reductionist? I think the way you're using that, he was no more of a reductionist than you are. In other words, he's someone who's giving an explanation. But third, there's the problem of evil and suffering, which I think is existentially the most serious problem you would have with that kind of worldview.
My view on evil and suffering is good. It's not a
natural thing. Yes, it's not good.
My guess is you're probably not. My guess is probably if I hit you, you'd think it was wrong. You wouldn't like it. You probably think the Holocaust was wrong. There are things which you probably think are wrong. Not just that you don't like the way it feels, but there's something in you that would say it's wrong.
I would agree with you. I'd say that it's wrong. But you probably know my answer is that I would say it's wrong because the way I've been brought up in my society and the way that I've been brought up in my morals has been imposed upon me by...
We have a radical denial, doesn't it?
Yeah, but see, I don't think if we have a long conversation, I don't think you'd want to say that. I mean,
you'd have to hit him a bit harder.
Well, I mean, you'd end up pretty happy in the Third Reich if it could just go on long enough. If enough people could be conditioned, and I don't think you want to say that.
The difficulty with pantheism is how do you stop the thugs? You know, how do you prevent? I mean, in India, in a classic pantheist society, thuggery has every bit as much right to exist as the most pious Mahatma Gandhi type pacifist, because there's no distinction between right and wrong.
Okay, there are other questions on a different kind of topic. Well, I mean...
Yeah.
I find it really quite confusing trying to follow what you're saying, because I think there's a number of things that you're using terms a bit, for me, loosely.
Wow.
So, like, to start with, right at the beginning of your talk, you said that science could only be developed in a non-polytheistic culture. Mm-hmm. Basically, to mean monotheistic. Right, so the first science, as it's normally understood, occurs in ancient Greece, which is a polytheistic society. Okay. A notable brand of that science is ancient atomism, which is obviously atheist, the first one. Now, to your whole discussion about monistic polytheism in India and its implications to Christianity, now, this we could probably argue for ages, so it's probably not worthwhile, but I would say that a monastic religion is not polytheistic, because the basic idea is withdrawal from the world.
A monist is not polytheistic.
Yeah. Oh, no, sorry, it's not pantheistic.
Not pantheistic.
Well, I say that because the ideal for the individual is withdrawal from the world.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's important because if you look at historians of science, particularly Catholic historians of science, they tend to find the beginnings, the revival from the Greek science in Europe in the Middle Ages, and they link this in with a trend in society which is away from monasticism, away from Christian monasteries, towards the kind of religion associated with Francis of Assisi, the kind of religion which is a celebration of nature. So science in the Middle Ages only comes about when you have a change towards pantheism. Okay, right, those are my 2 points.
Do you want to explain pantheism, polytheism, monism, and
yeah,
you
I think
a couple
monism
of questions
and monasticism got it all mixed up.
Sorry.
Yeah. Monism is just the idea that all reality is truly can be reduced to sort of one entity.
Yes.
Monasticism, very different. That's just a part of Christianity and also actually Buddhism, which would say that, as you said, a kind of withdrawal from the world, a self-denial, is essential to what it means to be an appropriate person.
Could you answer about the ancient Greek stuff?
Well, I think one has to ask questions about the nature of the science which the ancient Greeks did. So I think a lot of us would say that clearly they had a great interest in phenomena. And some of them, I think, had an interest in integrating phenomena, in understanding how different things were actually the same, in integrating. But in the main, it's just, when you look at Greek philosophy, it's an awful hodgepodge of speculative kind of ideas about how things might be. And as you say, you've got atomism, you've got Heraclitus's flux, you've got Plato's ideas. You've got a whole spectrum of mutually contradictory kind of theories about how things might be, and absolutely no interest in any kind of experimental investigation to distinguish which one is right.
Characterization. I mean, from this hodgepodge as you describe it, you have a Ptolemaic astronomy which survives in Europe for about at least 1,500 years.
Yes, a very well. Yeah, all right. Maybe we're getting
the way one author addresses exactly this question, Stanley Yaki, J-A-K-I. A Benedictine physicist, who wrote a book, actually, where we got the title of this talk from, called The Savior of Science, which you could look up if you wanted, J-A-K-I. He deals with exactly what about the Greeks. And he says that what goes on there is essentially just isolated discoveries, but that you don't find what seems to be the sort of chain reaction until you have this kind of monotheistic, in other words, belief in one God, as opposed to polytheistic, belief in many gods, until you have this monotheistic assumption of uniformity in nature. And therefore, what the Greeks do is you have some very serious thinkers, but who end up sort of discovering one thing or discovering a couple of things. But they don't assume, because of this uniformity, that they should pursue implications from these discoveries, and you don't get, as it were, a critical mass or chain reaction then of scientific discoveries. I have a copy of that book with me if you just want to copy down information about it afterwards to look it up in the library.
And the reason, of course, the Ptolemaic theory of the universe survived was precisely because it did, interestingly, unify the motion of the planets in a way which medieval scholars, influenced by Christian monotheistic views, found satisfying for their theocentric view of the universe. Unfortunately, because it also bought into Greek speculative idealism with its idea of the perfect circle, it held up science for quite a long while and required a huge intellectual breach before science could begin to advance again, because it got arrested in that. But
I two very brief things to what you said. One of which is actually entirely supporting what you're saying, because, in fact, the main aspects of Greek science, Plato and Aristotle, assume some kind of order and assume some kind of God, although it is very different from our God. And it's because of that that I would say that they have to count as science in the all-embracing term of giving it. Secondly, and we won't have time to argue this, the way that you're saying that Greek science is not science, I think if you're going to use that as a demarcation for science, really, you're going to have to say, well, the only thing that's science is stuff from the last 200 years. It's stuff that has finally managed to divorce God from the picture completely. So that if you're going to really be careful about what is and what isn't science, science is something that has nothing to do with God.
Well, I would prefer to defend the view that I don't think it would have got the kickstart it needed without this monotheistic worldview to inform it. But having got the kickstart going, it became, I think, very quickly such an intoxicating and powerful tool in its own right that it encouraged its own deification.
Do you think it will continue now that scientists no longer assume the kind of uniformity that we got from the idea of a monotheistic God?
Well, I think what's interesting is there's a sort of a cycle backwards now. You've got, for a couple of hundred years, atheism took over, and people thought the universe could just be self-contained without any kind of God. We didn't need God as a hypothesis. It was a mechanical system grinding on. Now we are getting closer to unified field theories and discovering what an extraordinary coincidence the universe is, how statistically improbable it is in a way, unless you're going to postulate that there have been millions and millions of universes, failed universes, of which this is the only one we know about, because it's the only one that worked, but there have been many, many billions of failed universes. But unless, if you are going to say this is the only universe that's ever been, then it is extraordinarily finely tuned. And now that the scientists are beginning to feel that, they're feeling very uncomfortable once again with their atheism. I'm beginning to move back in the direction of some sort of pantheistic view. Again, I don't think that's a very stable position for the reasons we've outlined, and it may very well be that at the end of the day, the argument from design will reassert itself, and we shall find more and more Christians taking Christianity, or at least theism, seriously again. But it's only a guess.
Yeah, you mentioned a couple of minutes ago the polynomial model of the universe. You said it's coming around to make things understand because it involves perfect developers and so forth. I was suspecting that the polynomial model actually begins to work. Well, yes, it did involve perfect versus perfect, it involved all the muscles moving and you play with every cycle, and I said that the reason it's coming around for so long was because it was almost a dumb heresy to suggest that it was wrong, to suggest the earth wasn't the universe. And that's why
I couldn't agree more. When I was a non-Christian, I was always citing Galileo as my great hero, because I mean he's the archetype rebel against these Christians who actually hold science back, isn't it? There are all these Christians refusing to look down his telescope. He's seen the moons of Jupiter. He knows they go around Jupiter. But none of the professors at Padua, all these religious ecclesiastical professors at Padua, will look down his telescope because they're quite sure there can't possibly be any moons around Jupiter. They know it a priori, by divine revelation or something. And so science is not allowed to advance, and Galileo is forced on the rack to recant. And the whole thing is a vicious piece of repression of modern science. all of which, of course, is right. It was an appalling thing. The medieval church did loads of things which I wouldn't want to defend by any stretch of the imagination. But the interesting thing is, I found myself, when I started looking at the evidence for the resurrection, being just as prejudiced and obstinate as the professors of Padua. There was the evidence of the resurrection of Jesus staring me in the face, but there was no way I wanted to look down the telescope at it and admit it was there, because it threatened my preconceived ideas. See, it cuts both ways. If you're really going to want to be a scientist and make a hero of Galileo, you've got to be very, very open-minded about Christianity. And I don't find many scientists who are willing to be that open-minded.
First time question.
Between the Adam and Eve thing, where do you draw the line in the Bible between what is story and what is...
Genesis 2:4.
I think when you read this is the account of, in Genesis, I think that is a clue in the text that you're now engaging with oral tradition or written tradition, a written down version of oral tradition. You're dealing with something which has come down through human memory, as opposed to a prophetic vision or prophetic revelatory word or something. I think Genesis 1 to 2 verse 4 has to be some kind of prophetic vision or word revelation, because of course there was no human observer for those events. So it can't be read as history. It has to have been given as some kind of vision or something to Moses. But from Genesis 2 verse 4 onwards, although I would not want to fight to the death over the fact that there are elements in it which may be non-historical, which may be symbolic, I believe we are dealing with things which have their roots in human racial memory.
You've had your hand up an awfully long time.
It's really important to ask the question why does God exist?
I'll take that one.
Please do.
In a sense, the definition that we have of God doesn't allow that question to be answered. Because God is self-existent. I mean, that's what it means for him to be God. And, I'm sorry?
Yeah, precisely.
Oh, I was just going to say.
That's what pantheism says.
Exactly.
But it's important to realize, you know, that which you decide requires no further why to be asked of it is God. For you.
Right, it's not only...
So if you identify matter as that, which is essentially what a Marxian view does. A Marxian view says matter is the ultimate reality. It's a form of pantheism, only it's a materialistic pantheism.
So you too would have something that's self-existent.
Yeah,
self-existent.
Right.
Going
back to the spring of destiny, we have said, and I agree with you, that we have a longing for destiny which science can't explain, and we've equated that with our longing for proving the facts. I would...
No, not equated, analogy.
Firstly, a small point, and I think that that's a very dodgy analogy, because you're equating something which is inherently scientific with something which is inherently different.
What do you mean by scientific?
Because the our desire for food can all be explained by science. Whereas you're then applying desire for God to a job, and God is something outside science. So you're trying to bring something into a bigger realm which you can't necessarily do. But that's not my main point. My main point is that you say that we have a longing for a destiny. And I think it's strange that you find that that's the reason that there is destiny. It seems to me that that's a much better reason for why we try and find the destiny and we try and find the God. And that, therefore, makes me wonder whether God is essentially our creation because we want it.
I think apart from Christian revelation, I have to say, I wouldn't want to use that as an argument either way. That's why I tried to get away from this idea of satisfying. I think that's true, but that's because I'm a Christian, and I've been told by God, I think in Scripture, that people do have those longings. But if I were to step back to my agnostic past, I would in a sense agree with you, but I would say on the other hand, no, that's not an argument that can't be fulfilled. I mean, it would be just as ludicrous to say that because someone does have a longing for something, therefore it must not really be there. It must be a projection. No, that doesn't say anything at all about whether or not the thing exists. Now, as someone who's a theist, I'm not surprised that God has allowed things that we have in ourselves to correspond with reality. So I'm not surprised that I can look at my hand and perceive it's there and that it really is there. And I can jump over a lot of epistemological problems, you know, because God created me and he created me to know and to be known. So I'm not surprised about that. But as a non-theist, I think it's not surprising that you might think that's a projection, but that's not an argument because it's a longing to say that it is a projection, just not an argument at all. The only reason I would use it as an argument, as Roy did, was because of what I've been told in Christianity or my own personal experience, but I agree you could have a different personal experience. I had a lot of qualifications in that. Was that clear? The basic point I was making is you can't use that as an argument.
Your first one was about poor analogy.
That's inconsequential. I mean, the main point about you can't use longings as an argument for its existence. That's if anything, an argument for its non-existence. It's just a projection. I'm saying no, that's ridiculous. It's just as a non-Christian with your presupposition, that would just be it's not an argument. It's just not an argument.
I'm prepared to grant your point that it's perfectly possible to be a fully logically consistent non-theist or non-Christian. It's perfectly possible to say these longings for destiny and so on that you talk about, which really require a theistic answer if it's to be satisfactorily answered, these are just wish fulfillment. This is the Freudian argument, that we project out from our human needs some God figure to satisfy those needs. And of course, you can be perfectly consistent in giving that explanation, that psychological explanation, if you like, of religious faith. There's no way you can disprove it. But my only concern is to ensure that if you want to take that view and dismiss religion, as it were, from your life explain it away as that kind of wish fulfillment. My only concern is that you face up radically and honestly to the full implications of the fact that you are then saying there is no purpose and no morality in this universe except that which you invent for yourself.
Well, why do you say creates? Like she deliberately made the choice.
No, you mean that it exists as moral people.
And this morality simply exists.
That's all one is left. That is all one is left.
But you're eventually going to get down to the problem again that you raised with the friend upstairs, that you won't have really any idea of a right and wrong ultimately. But we've already addressed that, so just to be fair, I want to go on. Even if it was unsatisfying, I think we gave the answer quite well.
Completely different point. If intelligent life was found on other planets in the universe and conclusively proved, would that affect your faith as Christian at all?
Well, I'm from America. I don't know if you consider that intelligent life. I'm sorry.
Wouldn't affect my faith in the least, no.
If we're going to be saved, then that was through Jesus, and he came to work and come to man. How would other people be saved?
I think the Bible is the only interest the Bible has is in addressing the real needs of us who have the Bible, which means on this planet, in the situation of this planet. I don't think the Bible has any interest at all in answering speculative questions about other worlds or whatever. It's for this very reason the Bible tells us absolutely nothing about the angels. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you ask me questions about angels, I'm dumb after about 30 seconds because there's so little in the Bible about them. Clearly, the Bible seems to suggest, to hint, that there's a whole world out there of these angelic beings who have some sort of history and some kind of moral responsibility and some kind of division between good and evil and so on. But quite how it all happened and what God's going to do about it, I'm afraid I really don't know properly, because the Bible is only really interested in helping us to know what God's purposes are for this human race on this planet and our destiny. And it would be purely speculative of it to tell us about other worlds that God may have other plans for, or no plan at all, or whatever.
But if you want some fun speculation, C.S. Lewis's Space Trilogy. I don't know if you've ever read it. It would be fun for you to read. Yeah. Okay. There was somebody else upstairs right now.
I think this is another reason why science needs God in some way. We are the Unitarian diversity thing, that if we've got multiple sciences here, and how can my universe all fit into one? If we've got one grand human theory, how do we get diversity out of it? So I don't know what you're doing.
I mean, can you clarify for me exactly what you're asking in putting this question?
What do you agree on that as a point? You know,
Wait, you mean, is the need for a unified field theory, you mean, an argument for the existence of God?
No, I'm saying, because if you've got individual scientific theories, like, you have no reason to believe in them all. If you have a unified theory, you have no reason to come up with that. So in some ways, you need a God to bring that whole together.
Well, maybe so. I'm maybe it's because it's late in the evening. But I'm not quite engaging, I think, with where you're wanting to go. You'll have to come and talk to me afterwards, because I'm not quite sure I understand where to go in responding.
Just about your the only tradition of Genesis chapter 1. I think I'm right that French is that the marine animals are created, and the birds are created, and all the things that were in the air before the land animals. Now that would go completely against evolution. So there is a creation. Now I come from a creation theory, by the way. And also, if you think it's all tradition, in Exodus chapter 21, it says that they're written by the finger of God. He says that the world was created in 6 days, and the seventh day rested. Did you grow up in it?
No. The word yom there in the Hebrew is used very similarly to the way we use the word day, and it means many different things. I'm not sure I want to say exactly what Roy said on that, but I think as a Christian who certainly believes in the truth of Scripture, there's nothing he said that's inconsistent with that.
I'm not necessarily the approximately 24-hour day.
Well, if it was a 24-hour day, I favour the view that it was a 24 hours of revelation. Maybe the prophet saw the vision over the space of 7 days. But I don't think the prophet could possibly have been given an accurate time scale to set against the things he was seeing happen. Now, they had to have taken place in a time-collapsed way. He couldn't possibly have seen them, in my view, across the spectrum of the actual time they took, if they took millions of years, as science would say. He would have to have seen it in a time-collapsed way.
And I would say, of course he could have done it that way. And of course the prophet could have seen it that way. But the point is, the word doesn't necessitate, the word yom, doesn't necessitate you, or me, or Roy, looking at it any one of those three particular ways.
No, there are a whole host, as I say, of ways of harmonizing Genesis 1 with scientific accounts of origins. Some are seven-day creationists, young Earth, you. I respect that view, but I don't hold it myself.
It just seems to me that you're weakening God, because you say, here we go, God makes the earth, God and the big bang happens. He puts it in the microwave and here it can only bring you being out from man. And it's like saying that you just say God takes this much time to weaken God by saying he's got to weaken himself to it. And also that why would he let millions of years elapse, or maybe 600,000 after human history, for them to discover, find their own right, how God did it. Why can't we just tell them? Why can't you just tell us?
Sorry, I'm not quite sure about that.
What I'm saying is, like, why does he have to leave it on to scientists to tell us how he actually did it? Why didn't he just tell us?
Well, he did tell us all we need to know. He doesn't bother to tell us the things we can find out for ourselves. And, if you're trying to pretend that there is no way in which external scientific knowledge is necessary, even to our understanding of the Bible, then I think you're wrong. We bring our human experience to the Bible with us in order to understand it. We can't make sense of any piece of human literature without bringing to that our own human experience in order to engage with it. And part of our human experience is our scientific knowledge today. And it's quite clear that there are many ways in which we understand the Bible better today because man scientifically has investigated his environment. Just the whole science of archaeology has illuminated the Old Testament in huge ways. So, you know, it's just not true to say that external scientific knowledge can't inform our study of the Bible. It does all the time.
Anyone else who's not asked a question yet?
Time's nearly gone.
Right.
Yeah, it's just a question, what's the point? There's been a lot of talk tonight on very hypothetical issues. I've heard a lot of people coming from the viewpoint of unprepared to accept God, so I can intellectually deduce him. All I like to my own experience is that I believe God has spoken, and he's spoken through Jesus. Does anybody who doesn't know about Jesus, and I'd like to find out, because I think that's the reason why it's a person that I'm going to go and keep your pictures from the far time. And so they'll tell you everything they know about you.
If we could accept that science implies monotheistic theory, you know, that would be scientifically invited to non-theism. What about other non-Christian monotheistic religions? Are they misguided?
They're not as misguided as pantheistic religions or polytheistic religions, but they simply haven't taken seriously what this fellow upstairs was saying, that at the end of the day, Christians say something has happened in history, decisive, in the coming of Jesus, which has to be engaged with and which radically qualifies all religions, including monotheistic religions. I mean, Jesus comes into a monotheistic religion, Judaism, that turns it upside down by his coming, because he is such a decisive and important person. And if one accepts his claims, all other religions are radically relativized by his coming and transformed by his coming. And so, I mean, if you're asking me about Islam or Judaism or whatever, I have to say, of course, there are things about Islam and Judaism that I agree with, because philosophically they're coming from the same direction as Christ was. But they do not accept Jesus's unique stature. And for that reason, yes, they are inadequate and misguided, if you want to use your word.
Two more questions. Okay, in the back.
Earlier when you talked about different kinds of knowing, objective, and that you can reject the scientific, I think that God has been very good, because I think you can in a way know him in a way that's more certain than you can know scientifically. We're not just saying, well, this theory fits from what I can see, but I think he's put in us something that recognises him beyond all doubt, and also something which is moral, something which says, I can't deny it, and my conscience says I can't.
Yes, and I do support you. I think that for people coming from a scientific background like me, may not be true for everybody, but for people coming from a scientific background like me, it was important for me to feel that there was an objective reasonability about the Christian faith. I'm not saying that, you know, if the Christian faith just offered to me a kind of intuitionism about Jesus, but that wouldn't have been enough to convince me, if you like, and make me a Christian. But it was important to me, and is still intellectually important to me, to be able to say, no, this is not just a mystical experience, like all the other mystical experiences that are offered around the world. But something happened in history, before many witnesses, and offers itself to me evidentially, out there, in the real world, concrete world. That matters to me. And but I'm not denying in any way what you say about the fact that when we recognize who Jesus is, it's not because we have proven the resurrection. to ourselves that it happened. I mean, you can prove to yourself the resurrection happened. It'd still be a very, very long way from becoming a Christian, I think. Because fundamentally, a personal engagement with Jesus is involved. That's why I said, I see human cognition as a kind of ellipse with two foci. There is the objective foci, the scientific knowledge, the sort of thing which distance myself from what I'm observing and try to work out, you know, what's happening. And there's the subjective foci, in which I am very much involved in the process of knowing, and in which my intuition and my subjectivities and my emotions, perhaps, are very much bound up with the sort of knowing that I'm talking about. And clearly, I mean, science majors, if you like, science shuts one eye and just looks down its objective focus. Mysticism and a lot of religious consciousness shuts the right eye, doesn't look at the objective sort of things at all, and just concentrates on the inner intuitional life of the human being, the spiritual consciousness. It seems to me that Christianity does offer itself in a remarkable way, in kind of two-eyed way, and says, look, something did happen in history, objective, which you can look at and examine as a scientist if you want to, and satisfy yourself about in that way. But it's not enough, because what is being offered to you here is not just a remote figure or a remote figure of history or an intellectual theory. What is being offered to you is a living person. And the important thing about persons, of course, is that they are objective realities, different from me, distant from me. I mean, I can investigate them, if you like, scientifically, if I want to, like a doctor does. But if I really want to know them as persons, then I have to get involved with them at this other level of knowing, this mutual knowing and being known, this subjective commitment, without which, though I may know a lot about them, in the sense of savoir, there is no real comprendre, there is no real personal engagement with the person. I think when Christians talk about knowing Christ, you see, they mean that sort of personal knowing, which has an objective focus in history, the real man Jesus who really lived, but also has a subjective focus, a personal engagement with the risen Jesus in the here and now. And those two things blend together in a way that I don't think you can say is repeated in any other religion, and brings with it, I think, a sense of assurance in that personal relationship, which is quite special and different.